Good morning. Here begins the live broadcast day for Free Radio Santa Cruz. We stream live at freakradio.org. We broadcast over the air at 101.3 on the FM dial. If you're listening to us on radio now and you ever wish to switch over to our free stream online, go to our webpage at freakradio.org, that's freakradio.org, and follow the instructions to pick up our free streaming service. Good morning again, folks. I'm Ren Tawil. This is the Mideast Migraine Show for Saturday, the last day of January, January 31st, 2015. It's 11:08 a.m. Interesting, the reverberating sounds we have here if you touch something the wrong way. Saturday editions of the Mideast Migraine Show are, of course, dedicated to the readings of current, or roughly current, vital literature, as in books, about the situation in Israel and Palestine. We are soon to close up the reading of Freedom Sailors, a 2012 nonfiction rendition of the events of August, primarily of August 2008. The full formal title of the book is Freedom Sailors, the Inside Story of the Free Gaza Movement's First Voyage to Challenge Israel's Illegal Blockade of Gaza and How We Succeeded in Spite of Ourselves. Edited by Greta Berlin and Bill Dienst, MD, both of whom were there, as was I, committing this hardly criminal act of daring to break the Israeli siege against the Gaza Strip. But first, there's this, movie that's been receiving an awful lot of attention lately. It's been lauded by many as a cinematic masterwork. Directed by Clint Eastwood, it's called American Sniper. And generally, the downside, the people who tend to criticize this movie have their issues with it having to do what serving as a sniper in the U.S. Armed Forces in Iraq and perhaps in Afghanistan, what that's really like. And that's the kind of dissent and discussion that you're hearing. What I'm about to tell you is something that you don't hear very much of, if at all, on mainstream media. This is from the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. It's part of an action alert sent to people like me who are on their list. American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, or ADC, requests public statements from Clint Eastwood and star of the movie Bradley Cooper, Washington, D.C., January 22. I'm starting to hear myself too much in my ears. There we go. Okay. 122. The American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee has delivered letters to American Sniper director Clint Eastwood and actor Bradley Cooper regarding the escalation of moviegoers' threats against the Muslim and Arab communities. Here are three samples of tweets that have, I'm not sure who they've been sent to, but here are the samples. Someone wrote, American Sniper has me wanting to go shoot some ragheads. Another one says, nice to see a movie where the Muslims are portrayed for who they really are. Vermin scum intent on destroying the U.S. America. The U.S. America. And I don't use Twitter really hardly at all, virtually not at all, so I'm not sure how this works. The message itself is followed by # American Sniper, so I take it to mean that that was sent to American Sniper. And here's another one that ends with # American Sniper. American Sniper made me appreciate the work our soldiers do and also made me hate camel riding ragheads loads more. And So I'm right here with you, folks. Easing my raspy vocal cords here. It says the ADC letters. The aforementioned ADC letters request that Eastwood and Cooper make public statements condemning American Sniper-related racist remarks. Many published via Twitter and other social media, in standing for unity, ADC believes that given Eastwood and Cooper's involvement with the controversial film, they may use their influence to quell the danger facing our community, which is to say the Arab American and Muslim communities. We call on ADC and community members to tweet the hashmark American Sniper hashtag, calling on Eastwood, Cooper, and the public to stand together against bigotry. ADC has issued a community advisory regarding an escalation of violent threats made online against Muslims and Arabs as a result of American Sniper, the film. ADC is working directly with the Federal Bureau of Investigation and local law enforcement on addressing these threats. If you or someone you know receives a threat online, please forward them to adc@adc.org. Send your email your information to adc@adc.org. Now, again, that was from 9 days ago. Let's look at a more recent I tried to line this stuff up before the show, folks. I couldn't find everything. Okay. This is from 5 days later, January 27. The American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, the ADC, is eager to update the Arab American community on its actions and developments regarding American Sniper-related threats and racism. Following an escalation in moviegoers' threats and rhetoric against the Muslim and Arab communities, ADC delivered letters to American Sniper director Clint Eastwood and actor Bradley Cooper requesting public statements. We also called on ADC and community members to tweet the hashmark American Sniper hashtag, calling on Eastwood, Cooper, and the public to stand together against bigotry. ADC received a statement from Warner Brothers Studios, as delivered to Reuters, that the company denounces, and I quote, denounces any violent anti-Muslim rhetoric, including that which has been attributed to reviews of the film American Sniper. Hate and bigotry have no place in the important dialogue that this picture has generated about the veteran experience, end quote. ADC is grateful for Warner Brothers' courage in standing up against bigotry. We thank our members and the public for raising awareness around this issue. While Warner Brothers has been responsive, Eastwood and Cooper have yet to respond to our requests. As you may have seen, ADC has been raising awareness of American Sniper-related hate rhetoric in a variety of national and international outlets, from BBC USA and RT to President Samir Khalaf appearing on Fox's The Kelly File with Megyn Kelly. And, of course, I believe that's ADC President Samir Khalaf. Amid heightened attention around these issues, ADC is witnessing a continued increase in threats and attacks against the organization and the Muslim and Arab American communities at large. ADC is working directly with the FBI and local law enforcement to address these threats. We reiterate our community advisory to the public and would like to remind ADC members that the public to remain alert, to remain stay alert. I don't think they just meant to say to remain alert, to stay alert. And once more, if you or someone you know receives a thread online or you're familiar with a case like this, please forward the details to adc@adc.org. So that's an angle to this whole thing about American Sniper that's not being tossed around much, if at all, on good old mainstream Western corporate-controlled news media. Okay, I did want to get that out of the way before the beginning of the book. One more item. This happens to be a public service announcement that I found here on the in the studio. And as long as the date hasn't passed, and I think it's worthy, I will read it. You are invited to a community meeting regarding the development of a temporary camp of last resort, using city parks at night to sleep. Wednesday, February 4. Again, that's this Wednesday, coming Wednesday, February 4th at 7 p.m. at the Loudon Nelson Community Center, Laurel and Center Streets, or Avenues. Room 4. That's Rabbi Phil Posner will talk about our petition to City Council and the ethical and practical reasons why parks are a temporary solution, insufficient, but better than the current situation, to helping lessen the suffering of homelessness in Santa Cruz. Steve Pleich of the Homeless Persons Legal Assistance Project will discuss, this is written funny, tons of colons here, Steve Pleich will discuss a shelter-first model for the homeless. Raven Davis, advocate for homeless civil rights, will discuss data regarding the current Parks and Recreation Stay Away Ordinance. Audience questions and suggestions will be heard. This quotation here, know that you are not obligated to finish an unethical task. I'm sorry, I'll start again. Know that you are not obligated to finish an ethical task all by yourself. However, as a person, you are not so free that you may abstain from it. Quotation from Rabbi Tarfon, who lived from 70 to 135 in the Common Era. Okay, obviously this PSA comes from the local Camp of Last Resort movement, or purveyors of it. The website is credomobilize.com/petitions/, all words separated by a hyphen, petition to establish a camp of last resort. Again, credomobilize.com/petitions/petition to establish a camp of last resort. No other contact information, not even a phone number. But I'll repeat the headlines. You are invited to a community meeting regarding the development of a temporary, quote, camp of last resort, using city parks at night to sleep, Wednesday, February 4 at 7 p.m. at the Loudon Nelson Community Center, Laurel and Center Streets, Room 4. I just may go to that. Not as a major or practiced advocate of homeless rights, but just to inform myself. Because I really do have a lot of questions about this topic. Okay, now, it is now 11:21. We're well into the show. I don't want to have to put it off any longer. Grab coffee while it's still warm here. Okay, in terms of the reading, I want to remind everyone that my archives are located at another website, radioforall.net. That's R-A-D-I-O, the number 4, A-L-L.net, radioforall.net. Radioforall.net is where you'll find the archives for the Mideast Migraines show. Type in Mideast Migraines in the radioforall.net search box, and you will see in chronological order, most recent show first, a listing of my shows that have been successfully recorded and transferred to the archive. If you want to leave a message with me before the mid-show break, you may send the message to the email address for this program, MideastMadness@gmx.com. Again, the address is MideastMadness@G as in George, M as in Michael, X as in Xavier.com. MideastMadness@gmx.com. No telephone calls, please, before the mid-show break. The ringers are off. And I like to just plow straight through the reading once I get started here. Without interruption. And again, the book is entitled Freedom Sailors by Greta Berlin and Bill Dienst, M.D. Freedom Sailors, the inside story of the Free Gaza Movement's first voyage to challenge Israel's illegal blockade of Gaza and how we succeeded in spite of ourselves. Copyright 2012 by Berlin and Dienst. This book is available in print at most online retailers, most online ones anyway. Copies may also be ordered at www.freedomsailors.com. Order a copy, get more information at freedomsailors.com, and here we go. The book has a total of 12 chapters and various endnotes. We begin chapter 10 right now. Chapter 10, Gaza on My Mind. Contributing writers to this chapter are Jeff Halper, Bill Dienst, Greta Berlin, and Sharon Locke. On August 26, Jeff Halper decided to leave through the Eretz crossing back to Israel. He was going to challenge Israel's right to close borders on the Palestinians and those who supported them and not let them pass. As he arrived on the Israeli side, he was arrested and thrown into prison. The Israeli media covered his arrest and also reported that the reason Israel, quote, let us through to Gaza was that he would be deprived of any publicity. Is that we would be deprived of any publicity. How wrong they were. That was an introductory paragraph to the chapter. Now here's the section written by Jeff Halper. Jeff Halper, by the way, as a reminder, is founder and co-chair of ICAD, the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. And this refers, naturally, to the demolitions of Palestinian houses in the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and to some degree in East Jerusalem. Jeff Halper is an American, in fact, Minnesota-born Jewish man who now resides in Jerusalem. He has an interesting bio, but I won't get into that right now. Okay, again, written by Jeff Halper here. Now, a few days after my release from jail, in the wake of my trip to Gaza, I'm posting a few notes to sum things up. First, the mission of the Free Gaza Movement to break the Israeli siege proved a success beyond all expectations. Our reaching Gaza and leaving has created a free and regular channel between Gaza and the outside world. It has done so because it has forced the Israeli government to make a clear policy declaration that it is not occupying Gaza and therefore will not prevent the free movement of Palestinians in and out, at least not by sea. Israel's security concerns can easily be accommodated by instituting a technical system of checks similar to those of other ports. Any attempt on the part of Israel to backtrack on this by preventing ships in the future from entering or leaving Gaza with goods and passengers, including Palestinians, may be immediately interpreted as an assertion of control, and therefore of occupation, opening Israel to accountability for war crimes under international law, something Israel tries to avoid at all costs. Okay. Gone is the obfuscation that has allowed Israel to maintain its control of the occupied territories without assuming any responsibility. From now on, Israel is either an occupying power accountable for its actions and policies, or Palestinians have every right to enjoy their human right of traveling freely in and out of their country. Israel can no longer have it both ways. Not only did our two little boats force the Israel military and government to give way, but they also changed fundamentally the status of Israel's control of Gaza. When we finally arrived in Gaza after a day and a half sail, the welcome we received from 40,000 joyous Gazans was overwhelming and moving. People sought me out in particular, eager it seemed to speak Hebrew with an Israeli after years of isolation from Israel. The message I received by people of all factions during my 3 days there was the same. How do we in the sense of all of us living in their country, not just Palestinians or Israelis, how do we get out of this mess? Where are we going? The discourse was not even political. What is the solution? One state or two? It was just common sense and straightforward, based on the assumption that we will all continue living in the same country, and this stupid conflict with its walls and siege and violence is bad for everybody. Don't Israelis see that? People would ask me. The answer, unfortunately, is no. To be honest, the Israeli Jews are the problem. Let me start again. Don't Israelis see that? People would ask me. The answer, unfortunately, is no. To be honest, we Israeli Jews are the problem. Remember, this is an Israeli Jewish man, native to America, Jeff Halper, speaking here. We Israeli Jews are the problem. The Palestinians years ago accepted our existence in the country, referring to the Israelis, as a people, and are willing to accept any solution, emphasis on any. It is us who want exclusivity over the land of Israel. It is us who cannot conceive of a single country, who cannot accept the national presence of Palestinians. And in parentheses here, we talk about Arabs in our country, not Palestinians, and who have eliminated by our settlements even the possibility of the two-state solution, in which we take 80% of the land. So it's sad, truly sad, that our, quote, enemies want peace and coexistence, and they tell me that in Hebrew, and we don't. Yeah, we Israeli Jews want, quote, peace. But in the meantime, what we did, almost no attacks, a feeling of security, a, quote, disappeared Palestinian people, a booming economy, tourism, and even improving international status seems just fine. If peace means giving up settlements, land, and control, why do it? What's wrong with the status quo? In other words, Jeff Halper here is saying, we Israelis are getting away with committing terrible war crimes, visiting them upon Palestinian people, and getting away with it because the world is refusing to hold them accountable in any practical manner. Let's continue with the chapter. When in Gaza, I also managed to see old friends, especially Ayad Al-Sarraj of the Gaza Community Mental Health Program, and Raja Sarani, director of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, whom I visited in his office. I also received honorary Palestinian citizenship, including a passport, which was very meaningful to me as an Israeli Jew. When I was in Gaza, everyone in Israel, including the media who interviewed me, warned me to be careful, to watch out for my life. They asked me if I was scared. Well, the only time I felt genuine and palpable fear during the entire journey was when I got back to Israel. I went from Gaza through the Eretz checkpoint because I wanted to make the point that the siege is not only by sea. On the Israeli side, I was immediately arrested, charged with violating a military order prohibiting Israelis from being in Gaza, and jailed at the Shikma prison in Ashkelon. In my cell that night, someone recognized me from the news. All right, right-wing Israelis physically threatened me. I'm sorry. All night, right-wing Israelis physically threatened me, and I was sure I wouldn't make it till the morning. Ironically, there were three Palestinians in my cell who kind of protected me, so the danger was from Israelis, not Palestinians, in Gaza as well as in Israel. Parenthetically, one Palestinian from Hebron was in jail for being illegally in Israel. I was in jail for being illegally in Palestine. As it stands, I'm out on bail. The state will probably press charges in the next few weeks, and I could be jailed for two or so months. I now am a Palestinian in every sense of the word. On Monday, I received my Palestinian citizenship, and on Tuesday, I was already in an Israeli jail. Fascinating. Incidentally, I don't mind adding that, as I mentioned earlier, I was a part of this remarkable adventure sailing into the port of Gaza City. This was in August of 2008, and all 44 crew and activists aboard the two vessels which sailed into Gaza City were also honored with Palestinian citizenship bestowed upon us by the Hamas government, and I still have my Palestinian passport, which is emblazoned with the gold embossed words "Special Ambassador" on the front. I'm sure all 44 of them said "Special Ambassador." So let's continue again. Where was I? I am now a Palestinian. Jeff Halper, Israeli Jew, speaking here. I now am a Palestinian in every sense of the word. On Monday, I received my Palestinian citizenship, and on Tuesday, I was already in an Israeli jail. Though the operation was a complete success, the siege will only be genuine. Oh boy, they leave. Not the best printing. Though the operation was a complete success, the siege will only be genuinely lifted, I presume, if we keep up the movement in and out of Gaza. The boats are scheduled to return in 2 to 4 weeks, and I am now working on getting a boatload of Israelis. My only frustration with what was undoubtedly a successful operation was with the fact that Israelis just don't get it and don't want to get it. The implications of our being the strong party and the fact that the Palestinians are the ones truly seeking peace are too threatening to the hegemony and self-perceived innocence of the Israelis, is what he's talking about here. What I encountered in perhaps a dozen interviews and what I read about myself and our trip, written by quote-unquote journalists, who never even attempted to speak to me or the others, was a collective image of Gaza, the Palestinians, and our interminable conflict that could only be described as fantasy. Rather than inquire about my experiences, motives, or views, my interviewers, especially on the mainstream radio, spent their time forcing their slogans and uniform prejudices on me. It was as if giving me a space to explain myself might deal a death blow to their tightly held conceptions. Ben Drury Amini of the popular Ma'ariv newspaper called us a, quote, satanic cult. Another suggested that a prominent contributor to the Free Gaza movement was a Palestinian-American who had been questioned by the FBI, as if that had to do with anything. In parentheses, the innuendo being we were supported, perhaps even manipulated or worse, by, quote, terrorists. others were more explicit. Wasn't it true that we were giving Hamas a PR victory, public relations victory? Why was I siding with Palestinian fishermen-gun smugglers against my own country, which sought only to protect its citizens? Some simply yelled at me, like an interviewer on Arutz 99. It's probably refers to either a TV channel, Arutz 99, or a radio channel. Someone yelled at me, like an interviewer on Arutz 99. And when all else failed, my interlocutors could always fall back on good old cynicism. Quote, peace is possible. Jews and Arabs are different species. You can't trust them. Oh, let me... I'm sorry, folks. I promise I will concentrate more now. I don't like backtracking any more than you like hearing me make these mistakes. And when all else failed, my interlocutors could always fall back on good old cynicism, namely, quote, peace is impossible. Jews and Arabs are different species. You can't trust them, end quote. Or bald assertions, quote, they just want to destroy us, end quote. Then there's the paternalism, quote, well, I guess it's good to have a few idealists like you around. Nowhere in the many interviews was there a genuine curiosity about what I was doing or what life was like in Gaza. No one was interested in a different perspective, especially if it challenged his cherished slogans. No one was going beyond the old tired slogans. Plenty of reference, though, to terrorism, Qassam missiles, and Palestinians snubbing our valiant efforts to make peace and none whatsoever to occupation, house demolitions, siege, land expropriation, or settlement expansion. Not to mention the killing, imprisonment, and impoverishment of their civilian population. As if we had nothing to do with the conflict, as if we were just living our normal innocent lives, and bad people decided to throw Qassam rockets at us. Above all, there is no sense of our responsibility or any willingness to accept responsibility for the ongoing violence and conflict. Instead, just a thoughtless automatic appeal to an image of Gaza and, quote, Arabs, we don't generally use the term Palestinians, that is diametrically opposed to what I've seen and experienced. A slavish repeating of mindless and wrong slogans that serve only to eliminate any possibility of truly grasping the situation. In short, a fantasy Gaza as perceived from within a bubble, carefully constructed so as to deflect any uncomfortable reality. The greatest insight this trip has given me is understanding why Israelis don't get it. A media composed of people who should know better, but who possess little critical ability and feel more comfortable inside a box created by self-serving politicians than in trying to do something far more creative, understanding what in the hell is going on here. Still, I formulated clearly my messages to my fellow Israelis, and that constitutes the main content of my interviews and talks. Number one, despite what our political leaders say, there is a political solution to the conflict, and there are partners for peace. If anything, we of the peace movement must not allow the powers that be to mystify the conflict, to present it as a, quote, clash of civilizations. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict is political, and as such, it has a political solution. Number two, the Palestinians are not our enemies. In fact, I urge my fellow Israeli Jews to disassociate from the dead-end politics of our failed political leaders by declaring, in concert with Israeli and Palestinian peacemakers, we refuse to be enemies. Number three, as the infinitely stronger party in the conflict and the only occupying power, we Israelis must accept responsibility for our failed and oppressive policies. Only we can end the conflict. There ends the this contribution from Jeff Halper. In Chapter 10, I am reading from Freedom Sailors, the inside story of the Free Gaza Movement's first voyage to challenge Israel's illegal blockade of Gaza and how we succeeded in spite of ourselves. Copyright 2012. Referring to events in 2008. Now, it's 11:43 a.m. Pacific Standard Time here on the west coast of North America, Santa Cruz County. You're listening to the Mideast Migraine Show at 101.3 FM, streaming live on our online service for free, folks, at freakradio.org. Freakradio.org. This next section, written by Dr. Bill, co-editor of this book, August 27 to 28. This morning, I, along with Takis Politis, a university professor of information technology at the University of Thessalia in Volos, Greece, and Takos Karakis, a Greek member of parliament and also a podiatrist and professor of genetics at the University of Aristoteles in Salonika, head out separately from the others on our Free Gaza delegation. Dr. Kamis Elessi takes us to the Islamic University in Gaza City. Its campus is right next to the more secular University of Al-Azhar, which has more affiliations with Fatah, the ruling political party in the West Bank, while the Islamic University tends to favor Hamas. I have visited Al-Azhar University before. It has a pharmacy and medical school. So does the Islamic University. Based on their respective affiliations, there was armed conflict between students of these universities in the summer of 2007. There is still some evidence of damage and graffiti on the buildings here at the Islamic University, stemming from the June 2007 internecine warfare, but most of it has now been repaired. The campus is otherwise quite attractive, with modern buildings alongside mosques with tall minarets. We are taken to the office of Professor Kamel Shaikh, the president of the Islamic University. President Shaikh did his undergraduate work at Cairo University in Egypt. He then received postgraduate degrees in construction management at Colorado State University and also in the United Kingdom and Spain. Before 1967, there were no universities in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. At that time, students had easy access to universities in Jordan, Egypt, and the outside world. After the Israeli occupation in 1967, coming and going from Gaza became more difficult. Universities in the West Bank were successfully established in Hebron, Bethlehem, Birzeit, and later in Abu Dis, east of Jerusalem. In Gaza, the Islamic University was the first university to be established in 1978, 9 years after the occupation began. Al-Azhar University was then established in 1992. According to Professor Shaikh, the Islamic University's enrollment is currently 60% female and 40% male. They have hosted exchange students from other countries in the past, but this has become more difficult with the illegal siege. We are taken to an information technology lecture hall, which has state-of-the-art computer terminals at each desk. Later we visit the molecular genetics lab and then the anatomy lab with modern three-dimensional anatomy models, which can be viewed in cross sections. Computerized virtual anatomy lesions are viewed on computer terminals instead of cadaver dissections. We meet briefly with about 21 female second-year medical students who are all dressed conservatively. We depart the Islamic University, and Dr. Khamis drives us in his small economy car, which has been converted to burn propane instead of petroleum. Propane is currently in greater supply, and therefore less expensive because of the siege. There are also, quote, falafel mobiles driving around Gaza, which burn vegetable oil and other biodiesel products. The siege has made the local population very creative and innovative. We arrive at Al Wafa Rehabilitation Hospital on the northeastern margins of the Gaza Strip, about a half kilometer from the barrier with Israel. It's less than a half mile. Pretty much right on the border there with Israel. Continuing, we head upstairs to the main nurse's station. On the wall, there are pictures of two male nurses who are now martyrs. But these martyrs were not involved in any sort of armed conflict. They were simply trying to do their job as nurses. On February 7, 2003, the area where Wafa Hospital is located was under an incursion by IOF. These two nurses were moving patients upstairs on the men's coma ward. They both were shot and killed by a single bullet fired through the window by an Israeli sniper who was perched on the top of the adjacent building immediately to the west of Al Wafa Hospital. You can still see where the lone bullet penetrated through the glass here on the coma ward. The IOF, and IOF is a term you will come across many times in this book, the initials of Israeli occupation forces. To be sure, the Israelis don't refer to themselves as IOF. They say IDF, as in defense forces. Again, IOS stands for Israeli occupation forces. The IOF claimed that they did not know this was a hospital. Yet there is clearly a white flag with a red crescent posted on the northeast corner of the hospital, and the words Al Wafa Rehabilitation Hospital clearly written on the eastern side of the building in Arabic and English, but not in Hebrew. We tour wards full of people with shattered lives who have been forgotten by the outside world, but not by Al Wafa Hospital. A schoolteacher was shot in the head and survived in a persistent vegetative state. A man shot through the spinal cord and now permanently paralyzed. We also see genetic cases that produce orthopedic disabilities, like three girls from the same family who need a specialized attention in order to walk. Because of the isolation in Gaza, combined with traditional clanship, there are frequent marriages between distant cousins, and thus relatively high genetic diseases here. The sun deliquesces into the sea on the final night before the FG boats, Free Gaza boats, are ready to set sail back to Cyprus. Our hosts and the popular committee to end the siege have a big gathering in the Legislative Council building to send us off. The sun rises. Ten of the original international passengers who arrived 5 days ago on the boats have decided to stay, including me. Four of us plan to leave through Rafah this weekend. Rafah is on the southern end of the Gaza Strip, exiting into Israel. Four of us plan to leave through Rafah this weekend, and six others plan to stay on for longer periods of time and do solidarity work here. Before departure, we have a final gathering on the veranda at Al Dira Hotel. We each are awarded Palestinian citizenship, including a brand new Palestinian Authority VIP passport! Exclamation point. leaving with the free Gaza boats are local Palestinians from Gaza who have been unable to get out by other means. These include a family, a woman separated from her husband, and Saeed, a boy with a high-level amputation suffered from an Israeli mortar shell, seeking specialty care abroad. Picture here in the book, taking wounded Saeed back to Cyprus for treatment aboard the Liberty. Nicholas Bolo shows him the huge fish caught on board the boat. Nicholas. It is getting time for the boats to leave, so we head down to the marina by bus. It takes time to prepare the boats for casting off. There is both happiness and melancholy as Palestinian passengers say goodbye to their families on shore, not knowing if or when they will be able to return to Gaza. It is getting later in the day. The boat's departure is behind schedule, and there is growing anxiety that there is limited daylight. It would be best if the boats were able to make it out into international waters before the sun sets, just in case they have any run-ins with the Israeli Navy. Finally, the boats pull out from the marina at 3:30 p.m. with top speeds at just over 6 nautical miles. This leaves just enough time to get out beyond the 20-mile limit before nightfall. A half hour later, the fishing vessels turn around toward shore, and we can see four Israeli warships closing in from the north and south around the FG boats. At sunset, we are relieved to receive word that our vessels have made it out into international waters without any direct interference from the Israeli Navy, only intimidation. So ends the section written by Dr. Bill, co-editor of the book. I'm going to grab some more coffee here. My combination concoction actually of decaf coffee and chocolate-covered strawberry hot chocolate. In fact, why don't we go ahead and have our musical interlude right now? It's 5 minutes before 12 noon. Saturday, January 31, 2015. And if that jives with your personal time-space continuum, then you know that you may call in during this musical break. I will answer the phone first and decide if the call deserves to go on the air. We very often, this doesn't have so much to do with blatant content screening. It has nothing to do, not so much to do with blatant content screening. It's just that I tend to get in the course of my program here calls that have nothing to do with the content of the program. It has to do either with other aspects of programming here at Free Radio Santa Cruz, or it could just be plain wrong number. Someone trying to get in touch with someone in our collective without realizing that they're not here. So, phone numbers, both live to the studio here, and the area code for both numbers is 831 for Santa Cruz County, Central California. Area code 831. Line 1, 427-3772. Again, 427-3772. Line 2 is 469-3119. 469-3119.
كان بين ايديا قدام عيني رسم البراءة بدمع عيني وترجع فيا طلع اللي قالوا كان من خياله أتريها لعبة وهعمل ايه دخلت عليا أرجع بعمري ولا فكر فيه
All right, let's get back to Freedom Sailors here on the Mideast Migraine Show Saturday edition on Free Radio Santa Cruz, broadcasting at 101.3 FM, streaming live and free at freakradio.org. Free Radio transmits our programs to the public. In complete and utter defiance and non-cooperation with the FCC, so that we may present untainted by corporate hands and interests, program content to the community on a strictly grassroots level. We're reading Chapter 10, in the middle of Chapter 10, Gaza on My Mind, from Freedom Sailors. This next section, contributed by Sharon Locke. Newsflash, boats back Friday, August 29. The Free Gaza and the Liberty are arriving back at Cyprus any minute now, safe from their return journey that began yesterday. They are carrying 7 Palestinian passengers who, according to the requirements of the Cyprus authorities, have valid visas or second passports, yet physically could not leave Gaza because of the siege. I'm still here with 9 others. We had an action today at Erez border accompanying a female patient named Majdea to the crossing in face of threatened fire if we proceeded. She's been trying for seven months to get to her scheduled operation in an East Jerusalem hospital, a scheduled operation now, in East Jerusalem, to have a spinal tumor removed. Didn't get her in, but did get a, quote, promise of, quote, by Sunday when her current operation is due, and didn't get shot either, which was nice. Although she says, I do wish people wouldn't sing things like, we shall overcome, during what might be our final moments, though, especially out of tune. Having run out of coffee, I'm going to resort to more throat spray. Yeah. The article below from the Israeli press is interesting, particularly because of the official comments. There really is potential to sail again in a few weeks if only we can get some big donors to cover our debt so we don't have to sell the boats to do it that way. Here is the article from the Israeli press. It is not obvious what media outlet this was carried in. Quote, Israel allowed 2 boats carrying international activists and 7 Palestinians to leave Gaza on Thursday and sail without interruption back to Cyprus. The boats had been allowed to dock in Gaza harbor last Saturday after the governments decided not to clash with the 44 human rights activists aboard and play into what officials said was a clear provocation intended to damage Israel's public image. The Free Gaza movement said that among the Palestinians who left Gaza were 5 children, including 10-year-old Saeed Mosley from Beit Hanun, who the group said had lost one of his legs to an Israeli tank shell. Here they're calling it a tank shell. Earlier it was referred to as a mortar shell, so I don't know. Continuing. He left Gaza with his father to seek medical treatment abroad. Also on board was the Darwish family, who will be reunited with its relatives in Cyprus. I can't believe we're finally able to leave for medical treatment, said Khaled Mosley, Saeed's father. This is a miracle of God. Out of the 44 activists who arrived on Saturday, 10 will remain in Gaza to do long-term monitoring, the movement said. Remember now, this is reading from an Israeli article, Israeli press article. Continuing, the Free Gaza Movement plans to return to Gaza with another delegation in the near future and to ask the United Nations, the Arab League, and other international organizations to organize similar sea-based operations. Israeli defense officials said Thursday that there was no set policy on how Israel would react in the event that another ship coming from international waters tries to enter Gaza. Officials said that as of now, Israel knows of no plans for other boats to set sail for Gaza, and that if other boats did try to enter, Israel would decide how to handle the situation on a case-by-case basis. Each case will be examined individually, one official said. In Thursday's case, the official said Israel had been aware of who was on board the ships, including the identity of the Palestinians, and had not interfered since none of the passengers posed a security risk. None of the passengers was dangerous to Israel, and they were not coming into Israel, so there was no reason to stop them, the official said. And went on, if a boat, however, tried to take wanted Hamas terrorists out of Gaza, that would be a different story. End quote and end of article. This next section contributed by Greta, co-editor of the book, arriving in Cyprus August 29. We arrived safely last night. The trip home was much less eventful and much less emotional. We pulled out in the early afternoon of August 28 and pointed towards Cyprus. 3 hours later, just as we were getting ready to pass the 20-mile limit into international waters, the Liberty lost a fan belt. Derek hung over the side of the Free Gaza and passed them a new one and our toolbox, and we sat there a mile away from safety as the men on board the Liberty tried to fix the engine. We wanted to be well out to sea by nightfall, and we could see the Israeli Navy hovering in the background, watching us. An hour passed, and a loud huzzah came from the Liberty, and the engine roared back to life. Huzzah, huzzah. Ironically, the Israeli news reported the next day that we had stopped as, and I quote here, a provocation against the Israeli Navy, wanting them to attack us. If they had only known that once again our boats didn't work and we were sitting out there hoping the damned engine would flip over and start. On board my boat, the Free Gaza, this is Greta writing here, was a family of Palestinians who had not been let out of the concentration camp called Gaza for 5 years. The mother had given birth to her youngest son 4 years ago, and the family, living in Cyprus, had not seen him. The joy on the faces of Hana's family was worth waiting the extra time to leave. We had to make sure that the Cypriot authorities would allow them in. On board the Liberty was a 10-year-old boy whose leg had been shot off by the Israeli military. He was from Khan Yunis. The story is that he was standing with his friend as an Israeli tank invaded his town. A sniper shot him through one leg, and when he stood to run, the sniper shot him through the other one, causing huge damage to the leg. It was amputated at the hip. Again, we had to wait for Cypriot authorities to give permission for him to transit to another country. On the first page of the Cyprus Mail is a photo of the boy with Osama, one of our organizers. Even though we came in at 9 p.m., the media was all over the quay waiting for us. Although we didn't get seasick this time, many of us, because we are so exhausted, are feeling the land effects today, swaying as we try to walk down the streets. It has been a week of overriding joy, sadness at the condition of so many sick and wounded Palestinians, hope for the future, and disbelief that we not only arrived safely, but left safely. As we pulled out of Gaza yesterday, 7 Israeli naval vessels surrounded the Palestinian fishermen who joyfully escorted us 6 miles out. The last view we had of Gaza was of the 7 gunboats, Israeli gunboats, surrounding the fishermen. We've heard from our Israeli sources that they arrested 4 of them. Picture here of the SS Free Gaza and SS Liberty Free Gaza movement boats sailing away from Gaza City, captioned saying goodbye to us as we sail back to Cyprus. The fishing boats accompany us out of the port. Gaza City in the background. Now let's get right into chapter 11 here. It's 12:15 in the afternoon Pacific time here in Santa Cruz County. Obviously, we will not be able to finish all the chapters of the book, although chapter 12 is a short epilogue. I'll see what we can do here. Chapter 11 of Freedom Sailors. All right, folks, I really want y'all to pay close attention here because of all the many, many aspects of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, as it were, whatever you want to call it. This is perhaps the most important to understand about Israel's oppression of the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Chapter 11, Stealing Gaza's Gas, the Real Reason for the Illegal Blockade. This entire chapter was written by David K. Schermerhorn, activist and sailor aboard my vessel, the SS Free Gaza. David K. Schermerhorn. Why should Gaza be so coveted when Israel says they withdrew their illegal settlers and turned over the territory to the people, and all they have gotten in return are rockets from the, quote, militants of Gaza? Hold on, folks, please. Why should Gaza be so coveted when Israel says they withdrew their illegal settlers and turned over the territory to the people, and all they have gotten in return are rockets from the militants of Gaza? They continuously say they attack the Palestinians in Gaza because of the security of Israel is at stake. If they are to be believed, it is the Palestinians of Gaza who are the aggressors. So let's look briefly at some of the history of this war-torn territory and the real reason Israel continues to commit slow-motion genocide against the people there. There is a historical connection between the Gaza community and offshore fishery. In recent times, some 3,000 fishermen in over 700 boats made their livelihood in the waters off the shores of Gaza. Before 1978, when the fishing area included the sea off the Sinai coastline, the area covered some 75,000 square kilometers. The larger boats are about 20 meters in length and usually carry a crew of 7. These are Palestinian fishing boats Schermerhorn's talking about here. They are typically trawlers using downriggers to lower their nets to the ocean bed. Currently, their main catch is bream or sardines that average between 8 and 14 inches. Smaller craft, hasakas, normally deploy their nets a few hundred miles offshore. The nets are then hauled in by hand. These catches are very modest. On September 13, 1993, the Oslo Agreement was signed, marking the basis for a peaceful accord between Israel and the Palestinians. The Gaza-Jericho Agreement of 1994 outlined specific steps needed to realize the general provisions of the Oslo Agreement. Under its terms, the Gaza fishermen were free to use a marine corridor from their shores extending 20 nautical miles, bounded by a restricted or border zones to the north and south, abutting Israeli and Egyptian waters. However, beginning in late 2000, the Israeli military initiated its continuing campaign of intimidation and harassment against fishing boats that ventured near or beyond a 6 nautical mile limit. Their patrol boats attacked and harassed the fishermen on a daily basis. This is back in 2000, folks, 15 years ago. As of 2010, the Israelis have killed 18 and wounded over 220 fishermen. Among the warships used were ones in the Dabur and Dvorah class. Their armaments include 20mm to 30mm cannons, machine guns, automatic grenade launchers, plus high-pressure water cannons. Some have 700-mile ranges and top speeds of 52 knots. Originally, they were built in the United States, but in recent years, they are constructed by Israel aircraft as at a plant in the Negev Desert in Israel. No formal notice or explanation of these restrictions was ever given to the Palestinians, although the year 2000 is very important. Any written regulations have been enforced by Israeli machine guns and water cannons. Since the Operation Cast Lead, quote, ceasefire in January 2009, attacks by the Israeli Navy have become more aggressive, often occurring within a few hundred yards of the shore. Even the people of Gaza walking on their beaches have been wounded by gunfire intended for the fishing boats. The fishermen continue to be killed, wounded, or arrested. Their boats continue to be targeted or impounded. The noose of the illegal blockade grows tighter. Subheading, Israeli attack on Gaza fishing boats, stealing Gaza's gas. For the first 50 years of Israel's founding, the country explored extensively for natural gas or oil deposits with little success. The old Jewish joke about Moses walking in the desert for 20 years and going to the one country where there was no oil or natural gas seemed to be true. More than 400 onshore and 25 offshore exploratory wells were dug during that period with no success. Nothing major was either on the land or in the territorial waters of Israel. Therefore, Israel was obliged to import 85% of its energy needs by buying coal and petroleum products from Egypt, Russia, Mexico, and elsewhere. September 13, 1993. The Oslo Agreement was signed, laying the basis for peaceful relations between Israel and the Palestinians. May 4, 1994. PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat and Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin signed the Gaza-Jericho Agreement as part of the subsequent procedure called for in the Oslo Agreement. In that agreement, Article 11 established 3 maritime activity zones that extended 20 nautical miles out to sea from the coast of Gaza. 2 narrow zones running parallel to the boundaries of Egyptian and Israeli waters were designated no fishing areas. I'll say it again, 2 narrow zones running parallel to the boundaries of Egypt and Israeli waters were designated no fishing areas. Under the terms of the agreement, the larger remaining zone, and I quote, will be open for fishing, recreation, and economic activities. For the next 6 years, the fishermen of Gaza operated freely within the zone with no major confrontations by the Israelis. Apparently beginning in 1994. In addition, the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, Part 5, describes an exclusive economic zone, EEZ, that would grant Gaza control of all seabed assets up to 200 nautical miles from its shore. This is the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, Part 5. There is speculation that vast deposits of natural gas are located beyond the 20-mile maritime activity zone. Such a resource would give Gaza the potential of becoming another Dubai in a relatively short period if they were allowed to develop their own deposits. 1999, the British gas group, the BG Group, discovered a vast deposit of natural gas within Gaza's maritime activity zone. Over 1.4 trillion cubic feet, equal to 150 million barrels of oil, were estimated to be there. Again, over 1.4 trillion cubic feet, equal to 150 million barrels of oil, were estimated to be there. And this is natural gas they're talking about. Located about 15 miles off the coast, the deposits were named Gaza Marine 1 and 2. It was estimated that there were sufficient reserves to generate electric power for all Palestinian needs for a decade and still have a surplus to export. On November 8, 1999, Chairman Yasser Arafat signed an agreement giving BG Group 90% interests, with only 10% to Consolidated Contractors Company, an Athens-based Palestinian entity connected to the PLO. They and the Palestinian Investment Fund, PIF, had the option to later assume up to 40% interest. Parenthetically here, a final allocation of the rights continues to be contested between BG Group, Israel, Egypt, and the Palestinians in obscured ongoing negotiations. In the late 1990s, Noble Energy, based in Houston, Texas, began explorations for natural gas off the Israeli coast in conjunction with Israeli partners, Avner Oil, and Delek Drilling. March 2000, Noble Energy, quote, announced the discovery of the Mari B natural gas deposit located approximately 15 miles offshore and close to the Gaza marine zones. Initial estimates projected reserves exceeding 1 trillion cubic feet of natural gas. July 25, 2000. Yasser Arafat walked out on the Camp David meeting over the status of Jerusalem. But others working with the Israelis and Palestinians said that Richard Perle was the instigator of the conflict, telling Barak, and this would be Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak, that he should walk out instead and wait for a better deal from Bush when he became the new president. Being the year 2000, that refers to Bush 43, Bush the Younger, W. September 27, 2000, Yasser Arafat traveled 19 miles off the Gaza coast to light the first flare, stack flowing up from the natural gas deposit. An Israeli oil consortium had contested the Palestinian rights to the gas, but this suit was overturned in an Israeli court. Original estimates for development and production expenses were in the area of $2 billion. Profits were estimated at another $2 billion. In the initial stages, BG considered running an underwater pipeline 20 miles from Gaza Marine directly to Gaza, where it would be used in retrofitting generators to provide power. Excess gas would be piped to the West Bank or convert to liquid natural gas, LNG, for export to foreign buyers. This plan was abandoned in early 2000 when Ariel Sharon announced that the Israelis would never buy gas directly from the Palestinians. At that point, the BG Group negotiated with Egypt to run an undersea pipeline to a plant at Al Arish, Egypt. The gas would then be piped to Israel so that they would not have to deal directly with the Palestinians. Under pressure from Tony Blair, BG Group was forced to negotiate with the Israelis instead, who wanted the pipe to run directly to Ashkelon. Those discussions were so long and contentious that ultimately the BG Group closed their Israel office and again began dealing with Egypt. September 28, 2000. The day after Arafat lit the first flare stack, Ariel Sharon marched into the Temple Mount despite warnings by Arafat and other leading Palestinians. The predictable riots and deaths following this provocation marked the beginning of the Second Intifada. As a result, Sharon was elected Prime Minister in February of 2001. He reaffirmed that Israel would never buy gas from the Palestinians. After the outbreak of the Second Intifada, the Israelis began an ever-tightening blockade of Gaza. It had been blockaded since the early 90s, with fewer and fewer trucks allowed in by land and no foreign boats allowed to enter the Gaza port. Late in the year 2000, attacks by Israeli patrol boats against Gaza fishing boats began and have continued to this day. These attacks on fishermen started only after the discovery of the natural gas deposits and 5 years before Hamas freely won the legislative elections on January 25, 2006. It is apparent that these assaults on the fishermen had nothing to do with security or with Hamas. Instead, it had everything to do with Israel controlling a $4 billion resource belonging to the Palestinians. 2003, a platform was completed in the Maribee Reserve and gas began flowing through a pipeline to Ashkelon. Until 2009, the Maribee Reserve remained the only sizable reserve found in Israeli territory. So the Maribee Reserve is in Israeli territorial waters. Although it was significant, it did not approach meeting Israel's energy needs and was a finite resource. While there is no hard evidence yet, it appears quite possible for the Israelis to access the gas deposits located in the Gaza Marine from the Maribee platform. Slant drilling techniques now allow bits to reach up to 25,000 feet horizontally from a standing platform. October 2001. Following the 9/11 attacks, the U.S. State Department included both Hamas and Hezbollah on their terrorist list, although neither one had anything to do with 9/11. August 2002. In response to a request from Prime Minister Sharon, the Secretary General of the United Nations appointed Ms. Catherine Bertini as his personal humanitarian envoy to assess the humanitarian needs of the Palestinians. At the end of her visit to the area, she made numerous recommendations, including one that dealt with the fishing boats. In her report, she included a list of, quote, previous commitments made by Israel. Item 2 states, the fishing zone for Palestinian fishing boats off the Gaza coast is 12 nautical miles. This policy needs to be fully implemented, end quote. But it never was. Despite Bertini's recommendations, Israeli attacks became more frequent on fishing boats that passed a 6-mile limit. Most boats carry GPS, global positioning system, so that they could determine their exact positions. Some captains were intimidated by the Israeli threats and turned back before crossing the no-go line. Others continued to go farther out despite the increased danger of attack. The consequences to the fishing industry in Gaza are horrific. The fishery closer to shore has collapsed after so many boats were forced to operate in such a limited area. In addition, the waters near shore are polluted due to sewage pouring in from sewage pipes. This is one more example of an infrastructure crippled by the Israelis. Before the siege, Gaza's fishermen caught 3,000 tons of fish each year. Now it is less than 500 tons. In addition to firing cannons and machine guns at or near the fishing boats, the Israelis periodically introduce noxious chemical substances into the water fired from their boats that leaves a foul odor on any fish or crewmen on deck. It is probable that the chemicals are the same used by the Israelis in crowd control on land. Under the Chemical Weapons Convention of 1997, it is specified each state party undertakes not to use riot control agents as a method of warfare. On occasion, the patrol boats have purposely rammed into fishing boats, damaging the vessels and endangering the crew. Numerous times, the Israelis have forced fishermen to jump into the water and remain there for up to 3 hours until they are exhausted and close to hypothermia. Periodically, the Israelis impound fishing boats. By the way, there are very extensive footnotes in this chapter, and I'll probably have comments regarding some of the many footnotes in this book. Not just this chapter, but off and on in the course of the reading of this entire book here. Okay. For example, the last footnote number in place of asterisk kind of denotation was when I read the statement. Following the statement, each state party undertakes not to use riot control agents as a method of warfare. And then there's a little 15, and it refers to a footnote at the end of the book. Let's continue with the chapter. Periodically, the Israelis impound fishing boats and take them and their crews to Ashdod, Israel, or some other port. The crewmen are generally released after being photographed and interrogated. The boats are held for indefinite periods. Captured fishermen report that the Israelis pressure them to become informers in exchange for the freedom to fish. September 12, 2005. Israel announced that it had ended the occupation of Gaza and withdrew its forces. But it continued to maintain control of air and sea lanes, as well as all border crossings on land. The amount of vehicular traffic remained extremely limited and never approached a typical pre-occupation daily level. The ability for persons to enter or leave Gaza continued to be restricted. Permission or denial for passage was often arbitrary and unpredictable. The conditions of an occupation continue to prevail. I say again, the conditions of an actual military on-site occupation, the conditions of an occupation continue to prevail. January 2006. Hamas won 76 of 132 seats in the Palestinian Legislative Council in an open, honest election after a bloody battle with Fatah elements that were supported by both Israeli and U.S. interests. Hamas took control of Gaza. Israel and the United States immediately reiterated that Hamas was a, quote, terrorist organization and that they would continue to have no public contact with it. The restrictions at the border crossings were tightened further with even more severe limitations on the admission of produce, materials, medicines, and people. Anemia and malnutrition are widespread as a result. Early June 2008, Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak, former Prime Minister, instructed the Israeli Defense Forces to secretly prepare for an invasion of Gaza, later known as Operation Cast Lead. Footnote. June 2008. Israel contacted BG Group to propose renewing negotiations over the natural gas deposits in Gaza. Actual negotiations overseen by Ehud Olmert, former Israeli Prime Minister, were taking place in October 2008. It appears that Israel wished to reach an agreement with BG Group before the secretly planned invasion began. Footnote. June 19, 2008. This would have been about 6 weeks, well, a good 2 months before our voyage began. June 19, 2008. Hamas and Israel signed a six-month truce agreement calling for cessation of rocket firings by Hamas and military incursions by Israel. In May 2008, over 300 rockets had been fired. Hamas was led to believe that significant increase in shipments would be allowed to enter Gaza, but that never happened. Before the truce, roughly 70 United Nations and non-governmental agencies, NGO trucks were allowed to bring provisions into Gaza each day, compared with some 900 permitted before the Israeli clampdown in 2000. 70 compared to 900. Hamas was led to believe that a similar flow of traffic would be restored. Instead, Israel allowed only an increase from the 70 to 90 trucks. August 23, 2008, two boats, the Liberty and Free Gaza, sailed into Gaza Harbor from Cyprus, carrying 44 international supporters of the Palestinians. They were the first vessels to break the Israeli siege in 41 years. The Free Gaza movement had the venture. We passed within a mile of the Israeli natural gas platform servicing the Med Yavne deposit. It lies roughly 5 nautical miles from shore and 200 yards north of the Gaza corridor. The Gaza marine deposits are about 5 miles to the south and clearly within the Gaza corridor. As we saw in Iraq, the Kuwaitis were accused of slant drilling into their neighbors' oil fields, into Iraq's oil fields. There is speculation, though no available proof to date, that Israel is slant drilling into the Palestinian deposits. October through November 2008, I, David K. Schermerhorn, joined other international observers traveling aboard 3 separate Gazan fishing boats. We went to document events and locations and to hopefully serve as deterrence against attacks by Israeli gunboats. On both days, we were harassed by machine gun and cannon fire and explosive charges landing within a few feet of our boat. Several times each day, the largest of the 3 Israeli patrol boats came within 50 feet of our vessel as they raked the deck and cabin with a high-pressure water cannon. Any fish, loose equipment, or crewmen caught in the torrent were at risk of being washed over the side. All the cabin windows had been previously smashed by such assaults and were now quickly boarded up when the patrol boats approached. An Italian observer with us had been wounded previously by flying glass, requiring a number of stitches in his back. According to the crew, attacks of this sort occurred every day when a fishing boat approached or passed the 6th mile limit imposed by the Israelis. This pattern of attack began in 2000 after the natural gas discovery was made. I'll read that paragraph again. According to the Palestinian fishing crews, attacks of the sort I just described occurred every day when a fishing boat approached or passed the 6 mile limit imposed by the Israelis. This pattern of attack began in the year 2000 after the natural gas discovery was made. November 5, 2008. IDF forces killed 6 Palestinians while supposedly searching for a tunnel passing under the border. By continuing to enforce the siege, the Israelis never honored the conditions of the truce. But this incursion by the IDF was such a blatant violation, it effectively terminated even the semblance of a truce. According to the Israeli Intelligence Heritage Center, one rocket had been fired from Gaza in September and two in October, before the IDF incursion. Israeli spokesman Mark Regev conceded that Hamas had not fired these few rockets. During the next 5 weeks, 237 rockets were fired into Israel. Footnote. The provoked increase in rocket fire was Israel's public justification for launching the long-planned cast-lead invasion, despite offers by Hamas to renew the ceasefire. November 18, 2008. Israeli naval vessels attacked three Palestinian fishing boats located 7 miles off the coast of Deir al-Balah, clearly within the limits permitted in the 1994 Gaza-Jericho Agreement. 15 Palestinian fishermen and three international observers were kidnapped and taken with the boats to Israel. The fishermen were held for a day and then released. The boats were eventually returned, but damaged. The internationals were jailed in Israel for many days and then deported. November 18, 2008, an Egyptian court ordered the government to stop shipping natural gas to Israel. Under a 2005 agreement, Egypt agreed to deliver 1.7 billion cubic meters of gas to Israel over a 15-year period. The gas began to flow in May of 2008. A lawsuit followed seeking to bar delivery since the parliament had not given its approval. The court supported the lawsuit, and its findings are being appealed. Footnote. The potential cutoff of the gas from Egypt gave Israel even more incentive to take control of the Gaza marine deposits and to deny any benefits to Palestinians, whether Hamas or Fatah. December 27, 2008, 2 days after Christmas Day in the West, Israel begins bombing Gaza as phase one of Operation Cast Lead. The Gaza harbor was bombed during the hostilities, damaging a number of the fishing boats. More than 1,400 Palestinians were killed, over 350 of them children. January 18, 2009, Israel declared a ceasefire, ending Operation Cast Lead. February 14, 2009, the Gaza coast becomes a no-go zone. On Saturday, 14th February 2009, 23-year-old Rafiq Abu Riala was shot by Israeli naval forces while fishing in Gazan territorial waters, approximately 2 nautical miles out from the port of Gaza City. He was in a simple fishing vessel, not much larger than a rowing boat, with a small outboard engine, known locally as a hasaka. Rafiq, his brother Ajab, and another friend were following the course of a shoal of fish. A group of five more hasakas were out at the time, about a kilometer to the west of Rafiq's boat, further out to sea. An Israeli naval gunboat approached the area and began shooting at the other hasakas, which quickly changed course and headed east back toward shore. Suddenly, Rafiq realized the gunboat was bearing down on their hasaka. As he recounted the events of that day, Rafiq likened the predatory nature of the naval vessel to that of a wolf. It circled their fishing boat and began shooting heavy ammunition in their direction. The three terrified fishermen threw themselves down flat in the bottom of their boat. The Israeli captain ordered them via megaphone to raise their nets and leave the area. At this point, the gunboat was less than 20 meters from Rafiq's hasaka. The second time the gunboat came around, no attempt was made to communicate with the fishermen. Rafiq was desperately pulling in the nets with his back facing the gunboat. An M16 assault rifle was fired, hitting him twice with explosive dum-dum bullets, which peppered his back with shrapnel from the bullets themselves. The force of the shots threw him in the water, plunging him down about 6 or 7 meters below the surface. Rajab asked their friend to control the boat while he rescued Rafiq. Being a strong swimmer, he dived in after Rafiq and pulled him out of the water into the Hasaka. However, Rafiq was unconscious by this time. The outboard was being slowed down by the weight of the nets, so they headed towards another Hasaka 3 meters away, where they dumped their nets. The fishermen in this vessel had a mobile phone and made an emergency call. The stricken Hasaka reached port at the same time as the ambulance arrived, and Rafiq was taken to Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City in a serious condition. It would take Rafiq months to recover, to fully recover, yet he has a family to support. He had just married and his wife was expecting their first baby. After 5 years of working as a fisherman, he has experienced Israeli naval forces firing warning shots on many occasions. But this was the first time he has been directly targeted. However, Rajab survived being shot in the chest by the Israeli Navy 2.5 years ago. 18 Gaza fishermen have been killed by the Israeli Navy between 2000 and 2011. Footnote. Israel is attempting to create arbitrary no-go zones in the sea, enforced solely by the gun. They might succeed if it weren't for the resilience of the fishermen. All this is akin to what is happening on land. The Israeli occupation force has declared an area of Palestinian land 1 kilometer in from the Green Line a, quote, closed military zone, affecting an audacious land grab that threatens to swallow a vast swath of rich agricultural land all the way along the eastern edge of the Gaza Strip. Footnote. January 2009, Noble Energy announced the discovery of a vast deposit of natural gas some 50 miles off the Haifa shoreline. Named Tamar 1, it is estimated to hold 5 trillion cubic feet and be able to produce 50% more than the daily capacity of the old Mari B site. The stocks of Noble Energy and its partners, Delek Group and Avner Oil, have soared since the announcement. March 30, 2009. Noble Energy announced the discovery of another major deposit at Dalit, located about 30 miles offshore from Israel. Production estimates have not been released, but the two discoveries are considered sufficient to cover Israel's energy needs for many years. These two huge gas deposits fall within an area called the Levant Basin that arcs from Egypt to Syria, extending north towards Cyprus. According to the U.S. Geological Survey, the coastal areas from Egypt north to Syria contain 122 trillion cubic feet of natural gas and 1.7 billion barrels of recoverable oil. Already, maritime boundaries have been disputed, with Lebanon claiming Israeli incursions into their territorial waters. They have requested the United Nations survey and clarify their they have requested the United Nations survey and clarify their borders, but have been rebuffed. The UN spokesman stated that Resolution 1701, quote, does not include the demarcation of maritime borders. National conflicts and maritime conflicts are two separate things, end quote. Israel's Minister of National Infrastructures, Uzi Landau, has stated that they would, quote, not hesitate to use force to protect the gas fields. Footnote. 2011 and 2012, Turkey has expressed concern over a joint Israeli-Greek-Cypriot venture to explore for natural gas in Greek-Cypriot waters. Thus far, the Turks have limited their response to shadowing research vessels with planes and boats. But the potential for more significant confrontations exists. Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan has stated, Turkey will not allow Israel to exploit, quote, one-sided, the natural gas deposits in the eastern Mediterranean, end quote. The effort of the Palestinians to gain even limited recognition in the United Nations raises the prospects of another area of conflict. Despite the discovery of the huge Tamar-1 deposit, it is not expected to begin delivery until 2014 at the earliest. In the interest of finding a more quickly developed resource, Israel has demanded permission from the gas company Noble Energy to start developing the Gaza marine deposits that were discovered in 1999 within Gazan waters. However, if the Palestinians are granted even limited recognition by the UN, they would surely assert a more credible legal claim to the natural gas deposits off their shore. In such an event, energy-poor Turkey may well support the Palestinians' claim to the deposits more actively than in the past. March 2009 to the present. Attacks by Israeli gunboats and the Gazan fishermen continue unabated. Dozens of Gazan fishermen have been injured, some killed, or abducted to Israel. Many continue to have their boats confiscated. Although Israel supposedly allows fishing within 3 nautical miles of shore, their warships attack fishing boats at random and without provocation, sometimes only a few hundred miles offshore. Sometimes only a few hundred meters offshore. A few hundred meters. The stated Israeli justification is that weapons might be smuggled ashore. It is the same canard used against the flotillas attempting to bring goods and passengers to Gaza. In fact, the two main purposes for Israel's illegal blockade are, number one, to further tighten the economic noose around Gaza by further restricting the inflow of essential goods and the outflow of exports that could help revitalize a failed economy, and, number two, to deny the Palestinians access to natural gas deposits that lie under their waters and that would bring them income and energy independence. And that's the end of the chapter. There is a black and white picture here of an obviously badly damaged... Oh, by the way, there's one more paragraph in this chapter, kind of shoved off to the side here. It remains one more Israeli crime where the U.S. government is pointedly silent. Of course, referring to the two conditions that I read about Israel tightening the economic noose around Gaza by restricting the flow of restricting the inflow of essential goods and the outflow of exports, and to deny Palestinians access to natural gas deposits that lie in their waters and to bring them income and energy independence. Those two points remain one more Israeli crime of the U.S. government's pointedly silent. And the picture here of Darlene Wallach, one of the 44 activists who sailed. Darlene is inspecting the damage to a Gaza fishing boat attacked by the Israeli Navy while trying to fish in Gaza waters. I am going to complete the reading of the book with one 4-page chapter remaining, the epilogue. Of course, for a 2-hour episode of Mideast Migraines, the Saturday edition, that might seem like a very easy task to complete the reading of the book, but of course I have many, many comments and further notes to pursue at the end of this book. Folks, we have indeed, since November of 2013, almost completed the number of a fourth book. It took a good 6 months to get through Max Blumenthal's 2013 release of Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. And then Congressman Paul Finley's They Dare to Speak Out, People and Institutions Confront Israel's Lobby, their lobby in Washington, D.C., affecting legislative decisions and White House direction, leadership. And, of course, I read a very short but remarkable compendium of 8 articles, all written by Jewish authors, in the short paperback Reframing Anti-Semitism, Alternative Jewish Perspectives. And now we're just about to the very end of Freedom Sailors. I'm just taking a look at what's going on here. Please join me next Saturday for the completion of Freedom Sailors, 11 a.m. Pacific Time. And, of course, you're welcome to join me in 2 days, Monday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, for the weekday edition of Mideast Migraines here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, streaming live and free at freakradio.org. Keep the faith, as we used to like to tell each other in the 70s, in the 60s. Hang in, hang loose, and ta-ta.